So and to describe this kinematic dynamo, the most important equation here is this induction equation, which describes the evolution of the magnetic field, where the velocity field is given. For example, we can solve the Navier-Stokes equation and find this velocity fluctuation. So we assume that we know everything about this velocity field. So if the velocity field is turbulent, is given by this Kolmogorov phenomenology, then the RMS fluctuations of the velocity field at some scale separation lambda, scale is lambda to the power 1/3, which is directly follows from the spectrum. And the characteristic correlation time of the fluctuations at scale lambda, or the so-called eddy turnover time, can be computed from this dimensional argument like that. So from this, we see that the smaller the eddy, the faster it rotates. So the smallest eddy have the fastest rotation rate. Therefore, if we introduce a weak magnetic field is frozen into the weighted that viscosity is small enough, so that magnetic field is, resistivity is small, so that magnetic field is frozen into the fluid. And if it is frozen, then it will be stretched most efficiently by the smallest and fastest eddies, which are in which this field is frozen. So we should, the basic idea is that we should look at this spectrum, find the smallest eddy in which magnetic field is still frozen. And if now if we compute the rotation rate or eddy turnover rate of this eddy, this will be the dynamo growth rate. And the scale of the growing magnetic field will be the scale of this smallest rotating eddy. Okay, so now there are two possibilities here. So here again, we have the spectrum of the velocity field, and then depending on the resistivity, the magnetic field can extend all the way up to very, very small scales, below the viscous scales, or it can be cut off at much larger scales. So if resistivity is small, we have this picture. If resistivity is large, we have this case. And by the way, this picture also shows that magnetic field is growing faster at the smallest available scale. So in the first case, we say the Prandtl number is large because viscosity is much larger than resistivity. And in the second case, the magnetic Prandtl dynamo is small. So in this case, dynamo growth rate would be defined by the turnover rate of the smallest eddy, which can stretch this magnetic field. This is the eddy here at the viscous scale, because this is the fastest eddy which can still stretch this magnetic field. But in the case of the small magnetic Prandtl number, this eddy would be somewhere here. So the size of this eddy will be defined not by viscosity, but by the resistivity. This is the smallest eddy which can still stretch the magnetic field, so here. But what is important here, that when the Prandtl number is large, magnetic field which is concentrated here, very small scale magnetic fluctuations, will be effectively stretched by the velocity field whose scales are much larger than the scales of the magnetic field. In this case, everything can be described by assuming that magnetic field is stretched by the smooth velocity field. Because at such small scales, velocity field doesn't have any structure. Yes. Right. So growth rate here will increase when the diffusive time scale decreases, so it's still fast dynamo. Mm-hmm. So, but the very different situation is here, and it's more difficult. So, because here magnetic field are concentrated at the scales where the velocity field is rough. We cannot expand velocity fluctuations in small scale separation. So in this case, actually poses most problems, both analytically and numerically, and I would like to discuss this case next. So by rough, I mean that this velocity field is not continuous in the usual sense. It's got this exponent 1/3. Typical velocity fluctuations at scale lambda, scale is lambda to the power 1/3. So small Prandtl number dynamo is a very relevant a case for stars, planets, accretion disks, and especially for liquid metal experiments that so far that have problem in obtaining turbulent dynamo. So in this case, one can actually do some simple estimate. So velocity field scales like that in this turbulent cascade. Eddy turnover time is given by this formula. Then characteristic scale corresponding to this visc to this resistive cutoff is scaled like that with the magnetic Reynolds number. Substituting this back to here, we can find the dynamo growth rate scales as magnetic Reynolds number to the power 1/2. And actually, it seems to be observed in numerics. Although in this numerics, magnetic Prandtl number is not small, it's about 1, but it still shows that if we decrease the smallest eddy which stretches our magnetic field, the corresponding growth rate, the growth rate corresponds to the eddy turnover rate at this smallest scale. So it seems to be consistent with this general phenomenology. Okay, yes. There is a paper with some logarithmic results, and I think it's incorrect. I can talk with you, so I can explain why. I think I know it. I think it's 1997 paper. Yeah.
Beyond unity, there's actually no restriction, because as we explained in the beginning, what really matters is, of course, the turnover time of
the smallest, yes.
That really does scale with Rm to such a power. So based on the turnover time of the large eddy,
right,
this number can exceed unity.
Yes.
So at the moment, all these numbers, even up to Rm to 1000, are still below unity. So we don't really have that yet. But
right. So here I basically want to say that indeed this phenomenology where you should expect the dynamo growth rate corresponds to the fastest rotating eddy, it seems to be correct.
I mean, maybe you're talking not about a just small scale dynamo. I think you did not even sufficiently emphasize that you're talking about a small scale dynamo.
Yes, I'm talking about my turbulent small scale dynamo. Yeah, so. Okay, so next topic. So after all this phenomenological consideration, we can try to do some more detailed analytic derivation. So we indeed consider this induction equation. We assume that the velocity field is given, and again, there are two major questions: what is the dynamo threshold, the critical magnetic Reynolds number, and what is the special structure of the growing magnetic field, characteristic scalars in the spectrum. So, in these questions cannot be answered from dimensional estimate. These questions already require some computation. So, and first, how would we approach this problem analytically? I would like to show this some hand-waving argument, which is not precise, but it still give us some idea why the model, which I'm going to present next, namely the Kazantsev-Krafton model, gives quite good results. So if we assume that magnetic Reynolds number is smaller than critical magnetic Reynolds number, there is no dynamo because resistivity is quite large and it dumps all magnetic fluctuations. When we increase magnetic Reynolds number above the threshold of dynamo, dynamo appears because now velocity fluctuations can stretch magnetic field. So there are two mechanisms, stretching of magnetic field lines by small scale fluctuations and reconnected magnetic field lines because they're brought at very small scales with opposite polarities. So there is stretching and annihilation of magnetic field lines. And when magnetic Reynolds number is just above the threshold, stretching slowly wins. So, and I would like to demonstrate with this little, so we start stretching magnetic field, we bring it to smaller scales, and after that, we stretch it, but if we precisely at the threshold, stretching and reconnection are equally effective, and we don't stretch it anymore. But if we increase the threshold slightly, it takes many turnover times before we stretch magnetic field a little bit. So far we can introduce the following model. We can assume that velocity field is random because it takes very many attitude over times to do anything with the magnetic energy. In this sense, we can say that magnetic field, that the velocity field is actually Gaussian because we have to accumulate very many perturbations to change the velocity field, magnetic field. And second of all, we can say that velocity field is delta correlated in time, delta correlated with respect to what? With respect to inverse growth rate of the magnetic field. So, and then the velocity field, we need to know only the second order correlator of the velocity field. It's in general given by this formula. If we assume that everything is homogeneous and isotropic, of course it's a very ideal case, but this is the easiest case, then the velocity field, the velocity correlator depends only on two independent functions. But since it is incompressible, these functions are not independent, but there is only one function which describes the velocity field. Say V or say V. And same is true for the magnetic field. It's also incompressible. It's also homogeneous and isotropic. We assume that we average over many over some ensemble, so that these fluctuations can be assumed to be homogeneous and isotropic statistically. There are indeed, again, two independent functions, but since magnetic field is incompressible, only one function is independent. So, and what was obtained by Kazantsev is that this equation for the magnetic field correlator can be mapped onto the quantum mechanical equation. It's just a second order partial differential equation. Of course, each such equation can be mapped to quantum mechanical equation. So in this case, we have some psi function which can be mapped to the magnetic correlator. And this Hamiltonian here depends on some potential, and potential can be constructed once we are given the velocity correlation function and the resistivity. So if we know velocity correlation function, we know magnetic resistivity, we construct this Hamiltonian, then we have to solve this Schrodinger equation with imaginary time. And if we find growing mode, then we have dynamo action. If there is no growing mode, there is no dynamo action. So what we have to do, we have to construct this, look at this potential in this Hamiltonian, and remember that there is minus sign here, so if we look at this potential, and the fastest growing mode would correspond to the slowest energy eigenvalue because of this minus sign, which is a ground state. So if the ground state energy is negative, there is dynamo. If the ground state energy is positive, there is no dynamo. So once we found this ground state energy, we can find the ground state eigenfunction, and this eigenfunction will give us the correlation function of the magnetic field. And since it is a ground state, it has all these nice properties. It also can be done so one can show that it's a Fourier transform to K-space is also positive, which should be for the energy. Okay. And now, what are the results for small magnetic frontal number if we apply this Kazantsev model? So the question which I answer here, and I think I'll stop here, is whether a turbulent dynamo possible for very small magnetic frontal number. So the question turns out to be very old. The first answer was given in 1950 by Batchelor, who says that no, dynamo is not possible for very small magnetic frontal number. And his argument was very elegant. So he said, let us consider the stationary, steady turbulence, just Kolmogorov turbulence, without any magnetic field. In this turbulence, of course, neither velocity nor vorticity grows with time. It's statistically steady. So now he said, let us look at the equation for the vorticity. Equation for the vorticity, which is a curl of velocity field, is precisely the same as the equation for the magnetic field. Now, if we introduce magnetic field in this system. Then he said, let's assume that viscosity is equal to resistivity. Then these equations are just identical. But since vorticity doesn't grow in a steady turbulence, magnetic field shouldn't grow either if viscosity and resistivity are the same. So this was the argument. This argument was very powerful. It was printed in the first edition of Landau and Lifshitz's course of theoretical physics, this result that dynamo is not possible for small magnetic frontal numbers. But then in 1967, there was a paper by Krechten and Nagarajan. They say that this analogy is, in fact, not relevant, because this would indeed be true only if magnetic field had exactly precisely tuned initial conditions so that initially it's everywhere the same as vorticity field, which is pretty much set of measure zero. If you change slightly initial conditions for the magnetic field, there are no theorem which would prevent this dynamo from working. And these are numerical simulations. I think it was like 2000 something. I don't quite remember now the paper, but who actually tried to set up initial conditions such that magnetic field everywhere follows the vorticity field, and there was no dynamo. But if you slightly deviate from this condition, dynamo appeared. So, but in this paper, they just said that this analogy doesn't hold, so we pretty much don't know whether dynamo holds or not. Then Van Schen and Kichetinov applied this Kazantsev model to small scale, to small Prandtl number dynamo, and they saw that, yeah, dynamo is indeed possible. But now, and then numerical simulations appeared in 2004, direct numerical simulations. Quite recently, this question was again in the center of attention, which actually introduced a lot of confusion into the problem again. They said that dynamo is not possible for small magnetic Prandtl number stations. And then in 2007, when resolution of these numerical simulations increased, dynamo appeared. So what is the problem? What's really happening? So, and the answer is also is given by correcting Kazantsev model. If we look at the case of large magnetic Prandtl number, this configuration, and then we'll gradually decrease the viscosity, increase the scale of this velocity distribution. So numerical simulation shows that dynamo disappeared in this case. But if now, after doing that, you increase the size of your box, you increase magnetic Reynolds number, dynamo would appear again. So there is this jump in the critical magnetic Reynolds numbers for small, for large and small scale Prandtl dynamo. So for small scale Prandtl dynamo, dynamo is possible, but we need to work harder. We need to achieve even larger magnetic Reynolds number. And this is actually in this correcting Kazantsev model. So it's one can solve it numerically. And so this we did this with Fausta. So immediately when we learned about this numerical result that magnetic dynamo is not possible, we were quite frustrated by that fact. So we looked at this correcting Kazantsev model, and we saw that indeed for large magnetic Prandtl dynamo, the critical some resolution parameter, which is proportional to magnetic Reynolds number, is quite small. But if you go to the rough velocity field, to small magnetic Prandtl dynamo, you have to increase your magnetic Reynolds number by a factor of 6 or 7 to see the dynamo again. And in 2007, it was actually in 2004, it was already confirmed. In 2007, it confirmed again that indeed this curve, how critical magnetic Reynolds number depends on the Prandtl number, it indeed follows this curve, pretty similar to the curve which is predicted by Kazantsev correction model. And so I would like to conclude. So main aspects of kinematic turbulent dynamo with small magnetic Prandtl number are quite well understood, in this, at least in this simple case of homogeneous anisotropic dynamo. Dynamo always exists, but for small magnetic Prandtl number, you have to go to much larger critical magnetic number to observe the dynamo action. And this is, of course, a really big problem for numerical simulations and for real laboratory experiments, where once you start spinning your liquid metal, you excite a lot of turbulence, and if it becomes turbulent, this critical magnetic Reynolds number jumps by a factor of 6. So your energy, which you need to now supply to the system, jumps even higher. So it's really, really hard to see dynamo in laboratory experiments. Again, and I would like to stop here. And basically, the question which is still interesting is whether there is any system which or maybe solvable model, or any system which could present an example of a system where small magnetic Prandtl number dynamo is not possible. Because so far we don't have any either analytical argument or solvable model which would tell us that dynamo is not possible for magnetic Prandtl number. Okay, thank you. So here I'm asking whether this turbulent dynamo is possible. Of course, if you introduce in your flow some pieces of metal which kind of make it maybe more laminar or confine your magnetic flux into a tube with conducting walls. So of course you can. It's a slightly different system. It has turbulence, but it has not only turbulence. So then dynamo can be possible in such a system. We know these experiments, right? Which could produce dynamo. It's not small scale because with little because it's liquid metal, magnetic Prandtl dynamo is about 100 or 200. magnetic Reynolds number. So it's not small scale. So resistive scale is not small. So pretty much when you introduce these metals, you basically introduce them pretty much close to the resistive scale where all interesting physics happens. So it's not small scale dynamo, because you cannot really reach very small scales in this. Magnetic fluctuations cannot reach very small scales.
Yeah, but I mean, if you have a Heliger dynamo, you never expected any change in critical RM. I mean, as long as RM is bigger than 1,
the
Heliger dynamo always works.
But helical dynamo is different. It could work for any RM if you have large enough box.
Sure, but if you have, so it's different because there's an easy dynamo action going on. But if you have a Karaj experiment, of course, you may actually have the same thing. And the same with the
So possibly, yes. So we say there is a lot of helicity, maybe just what we see is just not the... But it's so hard to separate the scales, because large scale and small scale, just magnetic Reynolds number is 200.
Sure. Yeah.
This
publication also
No, this is... In numerical simulations, one can try to do that. But it's hard to do numerical simulations for very small. I don't know. Maybe Axel knows. So in this is turbulent dynamo, so it's fast dynamo. I'm not speaking about slow dynamo. You can construct some laminar flows which are slow dynamo flows, but it's not what I. Yeah, it's just different cases, of course. Yeah, so to stretch magnetic field lines, you have to somehow reorganize magnetic field lines. Sometimes diffusivity helps you to do that, to separate these lines and then to overlap fields, stretch them, separate again, and what and so on. But in this case, the flow is such that it doesn't have slow dynamo.
I mean, I think the reason for the confusion is the following. We were talking about the growth rate as a function of Rm. That's what you're referring to. So the growth rate is increasing. Is that another slow dynamo? But there is a question, of course, where does this curve cross in zero line? In other words, where's the critical point? And that one shifts. That's all you're saying. So once it has shifted further away, it will still grow with like Rm to the 1/2 the growth rate.
Okay. Any other questions? I've just got a quick question, actually, before you just leave. And you mentioned about the Kazantsev model, and you mentioned about the numerical simulations. I mean, how much connection is there really between the two? I mean, the Kazantsev is delta correlated and so on.
Right. So we would expect that Kazantsev model would work just for the dynamo onset, right? Because
sure.
It's just... But surprisingly, it works very well even beyond dynamo onset. So if for example, you ask what is the spectrum of the growing mode, not just really growing mode, it seems to be that the spectrum is also predicted by the Kazantsev model correctly, k to the power of 3/2, which is also pretty. So in pretty much, I would say that pretty much everything that all our intuition about turbulent dynamo, which we have, follows from Kazantsev model. We still don't have anything that wouldn't be in this model.
Right.
So surprisingly, it works quite well.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I will basically review some results that came from a numerical study that Julien Aubert and myself did a couple of years ago. And I'm not talking about actually small-scale turbulent dynamos. These are just the classical first principle geodynamo simulations that we did. Although in some of them, scales get fairly small, and in a sense, they also become turbulent, although Reynolds numbers go up to maybe maximum value 1,000 or 2,000. So they are not exactly laminar. But the important point is that these are rapidly rotating systems. So if there's any turbulence, it is more of the two-dimensional, has more two-dimensional character. Well, just a brief reminder about the outline of these typical geodynamo simulations. Here I've highlighted two points to distinguish what I will show from what Radostan Zimitev will show after me. There's a difference between our models in boundary conditions. We typically use rigid boundaries, and we use a fixed temperature contrast across from the inner core boundary to the outer core boundary. As I mentioned in my talk the other week, basically we find two types of dynamo solutions that differ in the nature or the topology of their magnetic field. And basically a dipolar and a multipolar class, and what this illustrates typical spatial power spectra of these two types of dynamo. So typically, the spectrum is fairly wide at spherical harmonic degrees from, say, 3 up to 12. At some point, of course, it must drop. However, the dipole part either stands out in a positive way in the dipolar class, or in the multipolar class, typically it is weaker than the higher multipoles. Now, this is a fairly diagram with a lot of information. What's plotted here is the type of dynamo solution, or whether or not we get a dynamo solution at all, as a function of various control parameters. So the Ekman number, or if you want, the rotation rate, is varied between these different panels here, starting at the lowest, at the highest Ekman number, lowest rotation rate up here, and then going in this way up to the lowest value of the Ekman number, fastest rotation. In each diagram, we plot here the magnetic Prandtl number on the y-axis, and the ratio of the Rayleigh number to the critical Rayleigh number on the x-axis. And the meaning of these different symbols is red are dynamos in the dipolar class, where the size of the symbol gives an indication of the magnetic field strength. The yellow diamonds here are dynamos of the multipolar class, and crosses, and this gray region down here is where we had decaying magnetic fields. So no dynamos down here. Okay, and because the emphasis here is on the magnetic Prandtl number, let's look how what we need to find dynamos at the low magnetic Prandtl number. Typically, what we see is that the dynamo region, as we lower the Ekman number, so as we rotate the system faster and faster, becomes moves down towards lower values of the magnetic Prandtl number. And also an interesting point is the region where we find dipolar dynamos becomes broader and broader, and the regime boundary towards the non-dipolar dynamos that are found at high values of the Rayleigh number also moves in this direction here towards, so the kind of transitional Rayleigh number for the transition from dipolar to multipolar moves up to higher values of the Rayleigh number. And typically at an Ekman number of 10 to the minus 3, we need a magnetic Prandtl number exceeding a value of about 3 or something like that to get a dynamo at all. Of course, we don't know how this boundary will, as we drive the flow harder and harder, it may be possible to find dynamos at lower values of the magnetic Prandtl number. However, as we rotate the system faster and faster, we find, even at fairly low values of the magnetic Prandtl number, we find dynamos of the dipolar class. The lowest value where we found such a dynamo of the magnetic Prandtl number is something like 0.06, at this little point over here. These regime boundaries here, of course, are here quite tentative. There are not very many points here. But the general trend suggests that if we could drive, in this case, at the lowest Ekman number even harder, we would find dynamos at even lower values of the magnetic Prandtl number here. Let's skip that. So the minimum value of the magnetic Prandtl number where we can find dynamos, at least of this dipolar class, seems to be a function of the Ekman number. And here we plotted in this diagram of magnetic Prandtl number versus Ekman number. At the tip of each of the arrows, the lowest value of the magnetic Prandtl number where at a given Ekman number we found a successful dynamo. And obviously there's a very systematic decrease. This arrow is a bit above our line here. But the reason may simply be that we weren't able at this very low Ekman number to drive the flow so hard to reach a dynamo at even a lower magnetic Prandtl number. And so this suggests a fairly empirical fit that the minimum magnetic Prandtl number varies as the Ekman number to the power 3/4. And if we use such kind of relation, we find that for typical planetary values of the Ekman number, 10 to the minus 14, we should be able to find dynamos at magnetic Prandtl numbers down to something like 2 times 10 to the minus 8, which is still two orders of magnitude lower than the typical value for liquid metals in Lewis 4. So from this, there should be no principal problem with the geodynamo in terms of the very low magnetic Prandtl number in the Earth's core. Yeah, I come to the magnetic Reynolds number. So this is a similar diagram as I showed before. But what I've plotted now is magnetic Prandtl number again, but here instead of Rayleigh number, it is the magnetic Reynolds number now. And there are no nice regime boundaries because I was working on that this morning when Steve Tobias came by and told me I have 5 minutes time to finish it rather than 35, as I thought. So I had to stop here. The symbols are the same, and now let's look at what value of the magnetic Reynolds number actually we can get dynamo action. And so this value is pretty much around 40 to 50, independent of the Ekman number and the magnetic Prandtl number, given that the Ekman number is low enough. So up here, at the highest value of the Ekman number, we find successful dynamos at a magnetic Reynolds number of about 40, but the Prandtl number is high. When we lower the Prandtl number, we don't find dynamos. At a very low Ekman number, so fast rotation, we are able again to find successful dynamos at about magnetic Reynolds number of 50, but now at a magnetic Prandtl number that is distinctly lower than 1. This is basically shows the same story. here again, magnetic Prandtl number, and here magnetic Reynolds number, and now the tip of the red arrow shows the lowest magnetic Reynolds number where we found a successful dynamo, and the tip of the black arrow shows the highest magnetic Reynolds number where the dynamo failed. So the critical magnetic Reynolds number should be somewhere in between. And independent of the magnetic Prandtl number, it seems to lie here in this range 40 to 50, where we define the magnetic Reynolds number with the RMS velocity and a global length scale, which is a shell thickness here. However, once again, a requirement at the low value of the magnetic Prandtl number is also that we must rotate fast enough or have a low enough ECMA number. Okay, that was more or less my whole story I wanted to tell here. So just to sum up again, in rapidly rotating systems, dynamo onset at low magnetic Prandtl number seems to occur at the same critical magnetic Reynolds number in the range 40 or 50 as it does at high magnetic Prandtl number. However, when the magnetic Prandtl number is low, what's required is also a low ECMA number, so rapid rotation. And the way to rationalize this is that it seems that, of course, when you have a low magnetic Prandtl number, your hydrodynamic Reynolds number is large, so you have a strong influence of inertial forces. And if these inertial forces are strong compared to the rotational forces, of course the nature of the turbulence, the nature of the flow will change. It will become more isotropic. So basically the idea is that at low magnetic Prandtl number in a high Reynolds number flow, hydrodynamic Reynolds number flow, we must fight the detrimental influence of inertial forces by having very strong rotational constraints, basically making the Rossby number or something like the local Rossby number, which could be a measure of the ratio of inertial to Coriolis forces, to keep it still small, and then you are able to find dynamos at a low magnetic Prandtl number. That's it. I think at the low ECMA numbers, it's really the small scales that are efficient in generating magnetic field. I mean, it's not, the magnetic field is large scale. It's fairly dipole dominated in the end. Yeah. Yeah. It typically is. I mean, this is helical turbulence, or if it's turbulent at all. So it's usually we find in these simulations, if rotational constraints are strong enough, that the flow is quite helical with fairly coherent helicity following this typical picture, one sign usually negative in the northern hemisphere and positive in the southern hemisphere. In what regime? Yeah, well, 50 or larger. Yeah, that's a minimum, of course. And some of these simulations go up to 1,000. We didn't do many experiments when we started from a very tiny seed field. But in the ones we did, I think it's large scale to appear pretty soon. In the kinematic state. Typically, yes. I mean, many of these dynamo are, I guess you would call it, super equipartitioned. Not by much, but typically at lower Ekman numbers, the magnetic energy becomes distinctly higher than kinetic energy. Definitely. As you lower the Ekman number, you gain magnetic energy, or the ratio magnetic to kinetic energy becomes larger.
If they're in the regime where core energy is balanced, then that ratio is reduced. Are they in that regime?
Well, that's a kind of paradigm for planetary dynamos. But that's a difficult question. I mean, we looked carefully at that, for example, looking at actually force balances in the vorticity equation. And it's not a very clear picture whether it's really in... somehow this balance must work, but how precisely, we couldn't really determine.
What about just from the energy?
I couldn't tell. And no. We must look at.
How do you explain that when you get the dynamo, you actually have a balance? The two forces do not share your energy, for instance? Or, of course, you have the energy that is more like the same slow rotation of the object. You have more balance between your hand and your hand. And that's the rotation, probably, is more important than you shift the ground balance.
Yeah, all these results are in this three-term balance, more or less. I mean, probably the essential difference is that in these dynamos, if you call it turbulent at all, it's a strongly two-dimensional turbulence because of the strong rotational constraints. That No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Well, all these dynamos are in a regime where the Rossby number is definitely less than one. Or clearly. If you keep the magnetic, I mean, if you lower the as you decrease the Ekman number, you lower the Rossby number. Not sure, probably I get confused now, but
So I would like to basically present my version of low magnetic Prandtl number convective dynamos, and I think I basically confirm Ulli Christensen's story. But my dynamos are from a slightly different perspective of a slightly different modeling assumptions and boundary conditions. So in this talk, I will not discuss dynamos which have particularly low values of the magnetic Prandtl number. What I would rather do is to discuss how things depend, how things change when you reduce the magnetic Prandtl number and sort of try to establish a functional dependence on the magnetic Prandtl number, which might help us to to extrapolate to values of the magnetic Prandtl number which are lower than we could achieve in numerical simulations. So just to outline the differences between my dynamos and what was discussed in the previous talks, with Christensen. So again, we consider the full three-dimensional self-consistent dynamo problem in the Bose-Nesk approximation, and we come up with these four non-dimensional parameters: the Rayleigh number, the Coriolis number, which is the inverse of the Rayleigh number. So of the Ekman number, so the Ekman number is 1 over tau. And then the basic difference between my dynamos and the dynamos from the previous talk is that my dynamo solutions are driven by internal heating. So we specify an internal distribution of heat sources, which is given by this beta here. So beta is the density of the internal heat sources, and that appears in the Rayleigh number. And the second important difference is the boundary conditions, where we prefer to use the stress-free boundary conditions rather than the no-slip boundary conditions. And well, there are two small advantages from this. First of all, you don't need to basically resolve thin boundary layers, and you need less resolution in your radial direction. And also, the stress-free boundary conditions generate large differential rotation, which is, we find, an important ingredient for dynamo action. Then I know that people have complained that stress-free boundary conditions are not physical enough, but my collaborator Fritz Busse, he always likes to argue that a turbulent flow, such as in the what is expected for the Earth's core, the Ekman numbers will not be very important, and this justifies the stress-free boundary conditions in some way. Right, so I would like to start with this regime diagram here, where I have a set of dynamo simulations, and I have kept fixed the value of the ordinary Prandtl number to 0.1, and the rotation rate, so the Ekman number here is 10 to minus 5, and the magnetic Prandtl number varies on the horizontal axis, the Rayleigh number varies on the vertical axis. So what we find is, of course, a region of self-sustained dynamo action here, and this is bounded by two regions of no dynamo action from below and from above, the brown and the green. And I would try to discuss why this happens. So, of course, for dynamo action, you need to have a sufficiently vigorous flow to excite magnetic field. And the second thing that you need to have is low magnetic field diffusivity so that this magnetic field does not diffuse too rapidly. And these two factors, A and B, are combined conveniently in the magnetic Reynolds number, which is proportional to the kinetic energy, square root of the kinetic energy, times the magnetic Prandtl number. And typically for our dynamo solutions, we find that for dynamo action, we need to exceed value of 80 to 100. So then this roughly explains what happens when you try to decrease the magnetic Prandtl number and keep above this this value. So you need correspondingly to have a more vigorous convection. And this is what we observe. So once I start to decrease the magnetic Prandtl number, I need to have a higher Rayleigh number in order to have dynamo action. So then one might think that basically to reach arbitrary low values of the magnetic Prandtl number, all one has to do is to drive the convection sufficiently strong. But it is not so straightforward, because then I run into this regime of no dynamo action, which limits my dynamo solutions from above. And our interpretation of this is that this no dynamo regime is due to flux expulsion. Right, and I would like to discuss this set of dynamo simulations, which try to justify this conclusion. So what you see here is a set of simulations with a fixed rotation rate and fixed magnetic and ordinary Prandtl numbers, and I only increase the Rayleigh number along the horizontal axis. So the kinetic energy densities, the magnetic energy densities, viscous and ohmic dissipations. And it is probably not so important what is shown in the various curves. The important thing to observe is that there seems to be a maximal value for the magnetic energy as a function of the Rayleigh number. And so there is an optimal value for the Rayleigh number for dynamo action. And once you exceed this optimal value, which in this case is about 14 times the critical for the linear onset of convection, the magnetic energy start to saturate here, and if you exceed it still further, they start to decay, while your viscous and ohmic dissipation seems to grow with the Rayleigh number. And this could ultimately lead to decay of dynamo action, as I have demonstrated here for somewhat different parameter values. But the idea is the same, so I try to increase the Rayleigh number in steps. And for the two intermediate cases, 500,000-600,000 Rayleigh number, well, you have here well-equilibrated dynamos, while if I increase the Rayleigh number still further, the dynamo, the magnetic field decays. Right, and so this is my important message. Basically, the region of self-sustained dynamo action is, after all, limited if you keep the magnetic, the ordinary Prandtl number and the rotation rate fixed, and there is a minimal value of the magnetic Prandtl number, which is well, for Prandtl number, for this parameter, it is about 0.1. And I have tested this actually with a number of runs in the parameter space. For instance, in this picture, I have varied all the three parameters, and only the rotation rate is kept fixed. So you could observe the same scenario here, and the only thing that I would like to point out is that this minimal value of the magnetic Prandtl number seems to decrease as the Prandtl number, the ordinary Prandtl number, decreases. So for instance, if I have here ordinary Prandtl number, the order 10, I will have a minimal value for the magnetic Prandtl number of about 3. Right, and again to my favorite regime diagram, I would like to use it this time to demonstrate what happens to the various properties of my spherical dynamos as I decrease the magnetic Prandtl number. So normally when we start at somewhat larger values of the magnetic Prandtl number, we find first regular and then chaotic dipolar dynamos. So these are the red squares here. When I reduce the magnetic Prandtl number, we find in the spherical, and if the dynamo action does not disappear, we might also find quadrupolar dynamos. So here are just typical snapshots of dipole dynamo at somewhat large value of the magnetic Prandtl number, so here this is 1, and a hemispherical dynamo for lower value of the magnetic Prandtl number. So this hemispherical dynamo is special because this is actually the lowest in the magnetic Prandtl number value that I have ever computed. So this is how the magnetic field will typically look like. And now to understand the temporal behavior of those dynamos as I decrease the magnetic Prandtl number, it is important to look in the interaction between the magnetic field and the convection. So the main effect of the self-sustained magnetic field seems to be to suppress differential rotation. And I demonstrate this quite nicely in this marginal case where the dynamo decays halfway through the simulation. So the top panel A is the magnetic energy. You see that the magnetic energy decays somewhere in the middle. And at this point, the differential rotation, which is the red line here, increases dramatically in the absence of self-sustained magnetic field and shears off the rest of the convective components. Well, the point I wanted to make is that the differential rotation and the magnetic field are strongly interlinked and coupled, and this leads to some sort of almost periodic almost linear in nature oscillations, as here it is demonstrated again in my smallest magnetic Prandtl number case. So the dipolar magnetic energies, the quadrupolar magnetic energies, and the kinetic energies. And you see in this time series that we observe this neat, nice periodic oscillations. Well, they could be followed also in the contour field of the magnetic field. So some fresh magnetic flux will emerge near the equator, will propagate towards, well, outwards and then towards the pole, and this repeats sort of until the same polarity is recovered again. And this scenario actually holds not only for the small Prandtl number dynamos, as in this case, and not only for hemispherical dynamos, but also for basically throughout the parameter regime. And then there is this more subtle dipolar oscillation here as another example of an oscillatory magnetic field. And I would like to finish my last transparency here with some energetics of my low Prandtl number dynamos. And this actually, again, amplifies the point which I wanted to make. So the regime diagram which I showed at the beginning of the talk kept fixed the ordinary Prandtl number and the rotation rate, while here I keep fixed the Rayleigh number, so the driving of the dynamos and the rotation rate. And I simultaneously decrease the magnetic Prandtl number, well, here, and the Prandtl number here. And on this side of the plot, you see the kinetic and the magnetic energies. They have various components. So the magnetic energies are with heavy symbols, and the kinetic ones are with light symbols. And these are the corresponding dissipations. So the point which I wanted to make is that as you decrease simultaneously the Prandtl number and the magnetic Prandtl number, the energy to grow, but the magnetic energies grow at a slower rate than the kinetic energies, while the ohmic dissipations grow at a greater rate. And if I'm able to extend this plot to lower values of the Prandtl numbers, I would expect that this would limit the value of the magnetic Prandtl number, which I'm able to achieve a dynamo action at the fixed values of R and tau. So basically, what I think is that the magnetic Prandtl number is basically limited. There is a minimum of the magnetic Prandtl number, but you could shift this minimum to lower value if you use lower ordinary Prandtl number and higher rotation rates. So this is all I basically wanted to say. Well, yeah, basically this is all in this plot. So what it seems to happen is that then I simultaneously vary the Prandtl number and the rotation rate as well. And so the lower value of the higher value of the rotation rate and the lower value of the magnetic of the ordinary Prandtl number seem to basically promote convection. So you have more vigorous convection. Yeah, this that happens too. So the convection becomes smaller scale. Too. Yeah. No, from the small radius which I observed. So I mean, if I come back to that picture, I guess here. So these dynamos here are about 20 times the critical for the onset of convection, and when I look at contour plots of the kinetic energy of the velocity field, they are quite small scaled, and the same happens basically with the magnetic field. So, we assume that the magnetic field lines are somehow pushed out of the vortices, and that. So this here is the mean, the axisymmetric toroidal component here, the largest one. This is the fluctuating toroidal component and the two poloidal components. So, this is the total energy, yeah. This is the total energy. So I just wanted to demonstrate that at the highest Rayleigh number, the dynamo decays. Yeah, the resolution here is probably higher here at the lower at the highest Rayleigh numbers. Yeah, because I remember that I tried quite hard to obtain this last cases and to confirm that. Yeah, that's what I find. I mean, so for instance, it's not that high. I mean, so it's 20 times the critical, which is not. Well, I mean, it's probably not quite comparable because here, I don't have this small scale turbulence which you probably talk about, and it's more like chaotic dynamos, more larger scales.
Yeah.
moderate rotation rate. And if we increase, if we get everything out, if we increase the writing number, we can lose dynamo action, but actually drive even harder we regain it again, but letting the multipolar dynamo.
Well, sure. I mean, so I wasn't able to extend my dynamos much further than that. So, I mean, I would not. Yeah, that might be. I mean, so unfortunately, I'm not able to extend it much further than that, and I cannot comment on this. No, I increase basically the thermal driving, the thermal driving. The other way. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Might be, yeah. That might well be it.
Something here? No? Let's see. Yeah, one. Yeah. Okay. Okay, the point I want to make is very straightforward and simple, so it won't take long. And it goes along some of the discussions we already have had with Uli's talk and Zimitev as well. Okay. I'm not allowed to? Well, I saw no indication on the website I shouldn't. Nice picture. I can remove it afterwards. Okay, just wanted to say a few words about this low PM quasi-geostrophic dynamo. So in a sense, it's kind of simplification of the dynamos that we've seen now. And the idea was just to start from this famous fluctuation kinematic dynamos to which Dan talked about today, that is this plot of critical magnetic Reynolds number or magnetic Reynolds number as a function of the Reynolds number for various types of dynamos. These points here are from a paper of Sekochikin for fluctuation type dynamos, but it's not the threshold, it's the growth rate, so you just look at the yellow and red points, they are above the critical, so they are dynamos. And these are for example, this is also a famous curve by Ponti for a Taylor-Green type flow here. About this question of whether when you decrease the magnetic Prandtl number, which is this, now these lines here are for given fixed magnetic Prandtl number, magnetic Prandtl number, whether or not you have an increase of the magnetic Reynolds number, the critical magnetic Reynolds number. And at some stage, if I understand when in the literature there was some fear that because of this part of the curve, you might have to go to very high magnetic Reynolds number for having a dynamo at all. And in the case of the stellar green, clearly there is some leveling off of the value. And now the interpretation of fluctuation dynamos also tend to show that there is some kind of leveling off. So I just wanted to put in this figure the results one has from quasi-geostrophic dynamos. And these are dynamos which are built taking advantage of the fact that global rotation, which we've seen is rather important for helping dynamo actions, can lead to having really two-dimensional features that you can model only in the equatorial plane, and then we can model, well, extrapolate the velocity, including vertical velocity of the parallel to the axis of rotation, with the Ekman-type pumping. So these are what these hybrid quasi-geostrophic dynamos of Schaeffer and Cardan are. Basically, you solve the Navier-Stokes equation in the equatorial plane, and you solve the dynamo induction equation in a full 3D. And the advantage is that you can have a coarse grid there if you have small Prandtl numbers, magnetic Prandtl numbers. And I show you what type of results you get with that. So the main advantage is that you can go to very low values of these magnetic Prandtl numbers while keeping a full dynamics of the, which is behind the dynamo. Just giving these numbers here, I'm defining that's important for the following. The Reynolds number in kind of an experimentalist point of view, that is with external parameters which are A, which is the radius of the sphere, and B is the radius of the inner sphere. So it will be like for geodynamics, it's usually like 0.3. And the important thing is that these are spherical quad dynamos. It's not convective. It's driven by the differential rotation of the inner sphere with respect to the outer sphere. And this is measured by the delta omega here. Okay, the rest is classical Ekman number, Rossby numbers. And this particular illustration here is for some kind of a record in terms of magnetic Prandtl number down to 0.003. And this is the values of the radial magnetic field at the surface of the outer sphere, which is clearly dominated by a dipole field in that case, with some structures here which are related to the Taylor columns along the inner sphere. So this computation is for a fairly large Reynolds number, 10 to the power 5, and a fairly large magnetic Reynolds number. And if you collect these points and plot them as the same graph as I had before with the Shekhar-Chikin thing, this is what you get. Basically go to much higher values of the Reynolds number. These are the red points here, for which are the lower, I mean, the critical Reynolds number, which are clearly above the ones you hear. It's above 10 to the 3, it's between 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 4. And these are full 3D computations that Philippe Cardin and the students are working on at the moment, which extend this to higher values of the magnetic Prandtl number, smaller values of Reynolds number. I was just getting to that. Yeah. In fact, that's one of the different. And also, I've put here values from the paper by Johannes Wicht, which is often referred to, although it's not been published, but Johannes was kind enough to send it to me. These are these two diamonds for full 3D dynamos against spherical quads. If I find these two values, if I use the same definition for my Reynolds number as François pointed out, based on these external parameters, but he actually had them given here in terms of these RMS values. And then, of course, they are much lower because this spherical quad flow is not very efficient in putting, in fact, velocity inside the fluid. So I guess the message here is that, one, we can get to very low Prandtl number in this type of system. What it does, I don't know what it's any important or not, I'm sure. That, again, we find there something which is really very stable, in fact, in terms of Reynolds number, but it's very high. Because we're using this external parameter definition, if we go to RMS typing, it's much more in the kind of typical values for having working dynamos. Of course, if you're building an experiment like we are doing and Dan Lathrop is doing, you don't get that directly. You rather define the size of the beast and the rotation rate, and then you get fairly high values, which is one of the difficulties. That's all I wanted to say. Well, in fact, I was thinking about that in the discussion here. I haven't done the exercise for the quasi-geostrophic dynamos. That could be easily done. And for experimentalists, it's not easy to do these RMS things. For numerical people, it's more easy. That could be done. But I think that, as well, Uli was showing for his results, that probably, again, some kind of, yes, rather critical, stable critical value for the magnetic Reynolds number.
Okay. So I only have one transparency, and I just wanted to recap on what laminar dynamos do. We did this work, Robert Cameron and I, on the Arhontis dynamo a while back now. One of the things we did was to try, because people were talking about it at the time, various values of the magnetic Prandtl number, and we didn't go over much of a range, but you can see there's one picture on the left, which is for nu over root 3 equals a quarter, and one picture on the right for nu over root 3 equals 4. So you only got a factor of 16 straddling nu magnetic Prandtl number of 1. And what's actually plotted here, the green curves, which don't look very green on the OHP, are the sum of the kinetic and the magnetic energy densities, and the red curves are the difference. Okay, so and the scales for the difference are on the right, the scales for the sum are on the left, and you can see that they're not very much, the difference. There is this slight interesting thing which doesn't relate to low Prandtl number because this is a high one, but this is a case where the magnetic diffusivity is very small. And this run was the only case with the Arhontis dynamo where we ever found that it wasn't in a completely steady state. It just sits there, it twitches at this very low level. And that's a mystery which we still don't really understand. But I think for today I'm mainly just going to talk about the left-hand picture, because there is an interesting issue with it. Now, first thing is, this Arhontis dynamo, what you do is you solve the momentum equation and the induction equation with a prescribed force, which is of this form here. And we've done it with a force always which is proportional to the viscosity. And that's really, for historical reasons, that's always what people did with ABC flows a long time ago. And so we just took that idea over. And what we saw was that the thing seemed to go into one of these Elsasser states where U equals plus or minus B, no matter what the value of the magnetic Prandtl number was, and it didn't really seem to make any difference. You know, the only thing that's significantly different in these two pictures is that in this one, the velocity, you've got a much lower level for the sum of the kinetic and magnetic energies, and what's happening is that the magnetic field is basically dragging the velocity down with it. If you just had a nu of 100, the velocity would evolve to a certain, a nu equals 400, the thing would go quite fast. But because you've got a lot of magnetic diffusivity in, the magnetic field is sort of grabbing hold of the velocity. And then the funny thing about these dynamos is the magnetic and the velocity fields are sort of slave to one another. And what's happening is that the magnetic field is getting hold of the velocity field and it's dragging it down to a much lower level, and that's why there's less energy in these two cases, in the kinetic and the magnetic energy here. But they are the same as one another. And basically U is plus or minus B in this thing. In this particular calculation, U was plus B. And so that's the difference. So apart from that, you might say, well, it seems that magnetic Prandtl number makes no difference at all to the operation of this particular dynamo. Now, that's the basic point I was originally wanting to make. But in the last day or two, I had some more thoughts about this. And one of the things which is interesting about this is the following thought experiment. Suppose that you keep the kinetic energy at a fixed level, and you progressively increase the magnetic diffusivity. At the moment, it's still pretty small. It's still a magnetic diffusivity of a hundredth, which is not big. But if you increase it, then there must come a time when you hit up against what's called the Backus band, because the velocity is going to, as you increase the diffusivity, the velocity itself is going to go down. The diffusivity itself is going up. And what the Backus band involves is the rate of increase in magnetic energy is governed by the difference between basically the maximum diagonal element of the rate of strain tensor and a number of order 1 times the diffusivity. So if you keep increasing the diffusivity, you must you keep also decreasing the rate of strain tensor, so because you're slowing the field down, because it has to work harder. And so there's got to come a point where this dynamo stops to work. Okay, I don't know, do you agree with me? No, nobody. So when this dynamo stops to work, then that means the dynamo suddenly falls apart, and you get a magnetic energy decaying to zero. Okay, so you might say, well, that's interesting. But now you've got no magnetic field in the problem, and the basic slaving mechanism, which enables the velocity and magnetic field to be in one of these Elsasser states, disappears once the magnetic decays, and so you're going to get a velocity which is no longer going to be proportional to sine z, sine x, sine y, or something very close to it. And that means that you're basically going to get, effectively, when the magnetic field dies out, you're going to get the unmagnetic R-Hunt is forcing, and we know what happens with the unmagnetic R-Hunt is forcing when you have a value of nu equals 1 over 400. It's incredibly turbulent. So the interesting issue here is that, as far as I can see, when you increase the magnetic diffusivity on that picture on the left, what's going to happen is you're actually going to come to a point where you make the thing go turbulent. And that, to me, is a sort of rather surprising conclusion, buying. You can induce a transition to turbulence by increasing magnetic diffusivity. But this is early. I've only had this thought in the last day or two, it may be, so I'm interested to see whether anybody knows whether it's right or wrong or can follow it. Anyway, that's enough. That's it. Yeah, it's the same, isn't it? Yeah, that's right. Calculation. Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the fascinating speculation with these things. By having U and B both in the problem and both aligned with one another, in some way you seem to be able to provoke it to be much more stable than it's got any right to be. And that's still an issue which we're trying hard to understand, but it seems quite difficult to get to the bottom of it, the stability of this arrangement.
Morning. I only have 25 transparencies, so.
Which one are we on?
One. I think I just put one in. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm hoping to address some of the issues that Chris actually brought out earlier, and also to try and link what Stas was talking about and what Uli was talking about before. And addressing this small PM dynamo numerically is a real pain. And I've put up here a few of the, and we saw earlier from Henri Claude, a different way of approaching these things, all the numerical, or some of the numerical attempts to address this problem. And so the most difficult thing you can do, I feel, is to try and address this kind of straight using simulations of forced isotropic homogeneous turbulence, which is what has been done in the paper by Iskarkov et al. It's like saying, well, actually, the low magnetic Prandtl number dynamo problem is a very easy problem, so I'll make it more difficult for myself. I'll tie my hands behind my back. I'll take something which is a very bad dynamo to start off with, and then I'll have a look at something to see whether that's I can get it to be a dynamo at low magnetic Prandtl number. So it's like saying, well, I'm going to make the problem harder to start off with. So this really is the amount of effort being put in. You can make things slightly easier for yourself by considering anisotropic systems like rotating Boussinesq convection. And the reason that helps you is, A, it's a better dynamo than homogeneously forced turbulence, and B, because it's convection, you don't have to put as much resolution in the third direction. Okay, so you can save yourself a little bit that way. And these are not rapidly rotating things. These are just moderately rotating, so they'll be turbulent in the kind of Stas definition. You could just not bother solving the Navier-Stokes equations. If you're only really interested in whether it's a dynamo or not, you could just solve the kinematic dynamo equation. So you prescribe the random flow, and then you don't have to resolve the dissipative range in the Navier-Stokes equations, which saves you, a decade, or, you know, gets your resolution down by a factor of four. And these are some of the results Stas was showing you earlier. So this helps. You just solve the induction equation. You could have a large-scale flow and parameterize the effects of the small scales using the subgrid scale model. So what you say is the scales which are very small, that Stas was showing you earlier, I'm going to parameterize their effects on the dynamo by using some subgrid scale modeling. And then I'm going to solve the dynamo problem with the subgrid scale modeling and see whether I get a dynamo at low magnetic Prandtl number. But you've kind of assumed the answer when you did the subgrid scale modeling. You're kind of assuming that the small scales don't affect the dynamo by putting them back in to the dynamo field. But you can get to very low magnetic Prandtl number. You could do what I'm about to talk about, so I'll talk about that in a minute. So this is very little effort, you see, for quite a lot of reward, which is where I like to sit. Or you could be even more, and this is very, very similar to the kind of results Henri Claude was showing earlier. Or you could be even lazier and just solve these things in terms of shell models, where you only have to solve about 100 ODEs, and you can get to very low magnetic Prandtl numbers. The problem is with this approach and this approach, you always run the risk of somebody saying that, you know, well, it's not real turbulent, or it's not real whatever. Okay, so I think the more effort you put in, the less reward. There's a kind of moral for everybody there, somewhere. Really? Okay, and this comes back again to the question Chris was asking, or talking about earlier. There are two things which might change the critical magnetic Reynolds number of any given flow. One is the type of flow it is, and the other is how turbulent it is. So imagine you take two flows with the same spectrum. So here are two flows with the same spectrum, one of which is coherent, kind of 2.5D of the types shown by Uli. Maybe you've got this by a rapidly rotating system. Maybe you haven't. And one of these is random, of the type discussed by Stas. Okay, and these two have the same spectrum. And in any given flow, you're going to have some of this and some of this. And the ratio of this to this will depend on everything you put into your flow. So if you rotate rapidly enough, you might have a flow that looks completely like this. If you don't rotate at all and you make it very turbulent, you might have a flow that looks like this. And most dynamos sit somewhere in the middle. So you can change the critical magnetic Reynolds number by just saying how much of this I have with this. So just by changing the nature of the flow, you can change how good a dynamo it is. Even if you actually, you could change the growth rate even if you were at large magnetic Prandtl number. If you were at large magnetic Prandtl number, this one would still be a better dynamo than this one. Okay? It just is. Why is it a better dynamo? Well, because there are coherent structures in the flow, and coherent structures are very good at stretching out field. By coherent structure, I mean just some structure in the flow which has a lifetime much longer than the turnover time. And these are the sorts of things you tend to get in astrophysical and geophysical flows because of rotation and stratification. So homogeneous isotropic turbulence looks like this, and most astrophysical and geophysical flows look like this, even if you're weakly rotating or not so rapidly rotating. Okay. So as I say, these two flows actually have the same spectrum, and they're very different in terms of their dynamo properties. If you have a look at the field that they generate, this one generates very wrinkled field, kind of random salt pepper-like field, and there's a lot of dissipation here, okay, because you get lots of blackness to white. In this more kind of coherent structure flow, you get these kind of filamentary type fields, and you fold better, and you have less dissipation. So you have better stretching, less dissipation. So these ones tend to be better dynamos than these ones. So what Fausto and I tried to do was to build a dynamo theory of a similar one to the one Stas was talking about earlier, based on having coherent structures in your flow. And it tends to go through in almost exactly the same way as the theory Stas. Well, there's competition between eddies, but because these eddies are long-lived, you can think of their dynamics kind of independently, and you can say whether each one, how each one might behave. I'll just sketch the theory, but I won't go into it. So as Stas was talking about earlier, if you have a cascade of eddies, or in this case you have a cascade of coherent structures, you have some big ones and some little ones, and there are two, the various important time scales. There's the turnover time of the eddy, which of course scales with its length. So the big ones are slower, right? And the little ones are spinning around faster, okay? And there's the local magnetic Reynolds number at which your eddy is going round, okay? The big ones are at large magnetic Reynolds number, and the little ones are at small magnetic Reynolds number, okay? Because again, that scales with the length. So if you look at the dynamo properties, the big eddies have an RM which is large, which is good for dynamo action, but a turnover time which is small, sorry, turnover time which is large, they go around slower, which is also bad, which is bad for dynamo action. And the small eddies have an RM which is small and a turnover time which is small. So there's some competition between this, and you can actually, depending on the slope of your spectrum, you can isolate which dynamo eddy it is that's going to win and be the one that's responsible for generating the magnetic field. And we work this out for a general spectrum. You can get a bit further by assuming that actually each eddy is a fast dynamo on its own advective timescale. Now, these dynamos, these eddies are moving around in a turbulent flow, so there's no reason for them to not be a fast dynamo. So you can make some assumption about their growth rate in the fact that if RM is large enough, then you will get dynamo action, but further increase of RM means that you won't get a significant increase in the growth rate for increasing RM. I should say, while we're talking about fast dynamos, there is some confusion. It's not really correct to talk about the fast dynamo problem when you're talking about flows at low magnetic Prandtl number, because the fast dynamo problem, you're really thinking about fixing a velocity field and then looking at the limit as RM tends to infinity. And sooner or later, if you fix the velocity field, then you will be in the large magnetic Prandtl number regime. So it doesn't really make sense to talk about fast dynamos at low magnetic passing. Okay, so what we did was we took a kind of pseudo 3D field with lots of coherent structures in, and because these are 2.5 dimensional, very similar to the way Henri Claude was talking about his quasi-geostrophic flows, you can go to very, very high Reynolds numbers and not quite so high magnetic Reynolds numbers. So these are just some solutions with PM small. Of course, it's then very easy to start increasing mu, so increasing the Reynolds number and having a look at what happens to the growth rate as you change the magnetic Prandtl number. Or an alternative thing you can do is you can take some of the spectrum and start filtering off scales of the flow until you go from the small magnetic Prandtl number regime to the large magnetic Prandtl number regime and see what effect that has on the dynamo growth rate. And that's what we did. So this is the last slide. So this is just a plot of growth rate against the filtering scale. So maybe I'll just draw a picture of what I'm saying we're doing. So we have our spectrum, which looks like this, and this is our dissipative scale, and our magnetic spectrum looks like this. Can everybody see that? Can anybody see that? Okay. And what we start doing is we start filtering the spectrum of this. We start taking out energy at the small scales until we actually get, we move from having a spectrum that looks like this to one that essentially looks like that, and then further to one that looks like this. So we move effectively from the low magnetic Prandtl number regime to the high magnetic Prandtl number regime. And we just have a look at what happens to the growth rate. No, we just take it away. So it's getting less energetic. But you have to remember, there's not a lot of energy in these small scales. I mean, this is a... this energy spectrum is...
Yeah,
well, these will be ones where the effective Reynolds number is very small. Yeah. Well, I mean, we take out all the scale. Eventually, we take away the whole flow, right? So this is the scale at which we've taken away. This is the filtering scale. So K fill equals 500 means we've kept all the wave numbers up to 500, okay? And then K fill is 400, we take it to 400. So what we do is the growth rate is actually largely insensitive to how much of the spectrum we've taken away until we get to K fill is about 20, okay? And K fill is about 20 is the dynamo eddy at which we think that's the one which is doing all the work. If you go back to this picture, and there are some better ones in the paper, if you go back to here, you can see that magnetic field is generated associated with certain eddies. And actually, probably have a better one. There are eddies which are doing all the work, and they tend to be on the scale of these things. So actually, when one takes away eddies on this scale, then the dynamo just tends to switch off and the growth rate drops. No, it's past that, because so that would be around about here. Okay. So we go from being a small magnetic Prandtl number dynamo to being a large magnetic Prandtl number dynamo to just essentially being no dynamo once we get rid of the dynamo eddy. Okay. So yes, exactly. So when do these eddies start being a dynamo? Well, they are the fastest eddies for which RM is greater than order one. Yeah, the ones going around fastest for which RM is greater than order one. If you go to bigger scales, they of course have larger, and because we've assumed that they're fast dynamos, their growth rate becomes independent of RM, so they're not as effective. If you go to smaller scales, then they have a local RM which is too small for dynamo action. Okay. Yeah, okay. Yes. Well, I don't quite know. One thing, we did this in a fairly crude way, which was to take away wave numbers, okay? And really, we think of these things as, you know, there's an eddy, and what we'd quite like to do is take away the eddy. And so I was talking to Marie Farge about doing some wavelet analysis and then taking away, you know, but it's not trivial to then, you know, to do that on the fly in a computation with the induction equation. Taking away spectral modes is kind of easy in a spectral code. Okay, just to summarize then, providing you're at high enough magnetic Reynolds number such that you do have some dynamo eddy which is at a Reynolds number greater than 1, then there is absolutely no problem, at least in these kind of coherent structure dynamos, with getting these at low magnetic Prandtl number. And I think this kind of ties in with what Uli was saying and the geodynamo guys. Because I think what they're in a regime where, because of the rapid rotation, they have lots of coherent structures. They're almost 2.5D, but they're in a bit like this. And there should be no problem with going to a low magnetic Prandtl number. If you're back in the regime that Stas was talking about, where you have a randomized phase, of course you'll eventually get a dynamo, but you might have to work 10 times as hard. And given that we're all right on the edge of being able to get these dynamos, working 10 times as hard, going to an RM which is 10 times as hard, is a hard thing to do. So I'll stop there. Magnetic cutoff is round about at K, for the one I've just showed you, is at round about K is 200. So. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I'm not going to argue about factors of 5 either way, but we could solve this at smaller values of nu and push our fit and then start filtering and filtering and filtering and move everything up. But what we would say is that the scale of which the dynamo works would still be at 20. If that was, and then that would be more convincing. We could move everything to the right except for the dynamo scale. No, I agree with that. Yeah, I mean, but we know where it is by plotting the spectrum to the magnetic field. Okay, maybe to a factor of 2 or 3. It was, yeah. No, but they're all. The thing is, these are all coherent. These are all coherent. So the lifetime of each of these structures is much longer than its turnover time. Now, the ones which are smaller have a faster turnover time, and they may have a shorter lifetime, but it's still much... That's what I mean by coherent structures. I mean, when you're going to do a statistical theory, you kind of assume everything's random and changes very quickly. We need those things to sit there and wrap up the field for a few turnover times for our theory to work. If it sits there and just does a little and then dies, then you're back in the Stas regime. Yeah. They're coherent. By coherent I mean in time. Yeah, that's right.
The time.
Yeah. Okay. Analytical calculations, the person you should talk to is Daz. But I mean, analytical, you're still going to have to be in the short correlation time. Even but numerically, we can show this by we take this pattern, and every so often, we mess around with it. So we have something where we can actually change the coherence time of the flight. So you take this pattern, and every torsi, you just kind of move it around. So as far as the field's concerned, you've just moved the pattern. And then you can look at what happens if you change that correlation. I would say so, yeah. I mean, anything you have that gives you coherence, I think, is going to help. It does. I mean, it may help only to a factor of two or something in RM crit, but given that we're all on the edge of something. Okay, you've been reading some of my preprints, or maybe you haven't. Okay, the other thing you can do with this flow, other than shift it around in time, is randomize its phases. So you make it coherent in time. This one. So you make it coherent in time. You keep the coherence in time, but randomize the phases. So you can have three flows with different spectra, one of which is coherent in space and time, one of which is coherent in space but not in time, and one. And this is always the best dynamo, and the other two are never as good. Yeah. Both. Yeah. No, oh, no, we don't know. We simulate the active scalar equations. But. That's right. Right. I agree. I don't know. You have to add a bit of this to that, which is something we're kind of doing, but it's very hard to say. I mean, it's an interesting question. Well, you know, if the coherent structure is at an RM at which it can be a dynamo, then you know that one's going to win. But if it's not, then you're not. If you have a dynamo at RM is one. If you don't, then. Yeah. But he's talking about real flows rather than what we're doing. How dare he, but you know, he is.